he were asked. The case wove through courts, but went nowhere. Consent between doctor and patient wasn't black and white in 1931. One court summed up the idea that doctors require freedom to make the best medical decisions. Without such, we could not enjoy the advancement of science. For most of history, the ethos of medicine was that the doctor's job was to fix the patient, and what the patient thought about the doctor's treatment plans wasn't relevant. Dr. J. Katz wrote about the philosophy in his book, The Silent World Between Doctor and Patient. Doctors felt that in order to accomplish that objective, they were obligated to attend to the patient's physical and emotional needs, and to do so on their own authority, without consulting with their patients about the decisions that needed to be made. The idea that patients may also be entitled to sharing the burden of decisions with their doctors was never part of the ethos of medicine. This wasn't ego or malice. It was a belief in two points. One, every patient wants to be cured. Two, there is a universal and right way to cure them. Not requiring patient consent in treatment plans makes sense if you believe in those two points. But that's not how medicine works. In the last 50 years, medical schools subtly shifted teaching away from treating disease and toward treating patients. That meant laying out the options of treatment plans and then letting the patient decide the best path forward. This trend was partly driven by patient protection laws, partly by Katz's influential book, which argued that patients have wildly different views about what's worth it in medicine, so their beliefs have to be taken into consideration. Katz wrote, "It is dangerous nonsense to assert that in the practice of their art and science, physicians can rely on their benevolent intentions, their abilities to judge what is the right thing to do. It is not that easy. Medicine is a complex profession, and the interactions between physicians and patients are also complex." That last line is important. Medicine is a complex profession, and the interactions between physicians and patients are also complex. You know what profession is the same? Financial advice. I can't tell you what to do with your money, because I don't know you. I don't know what you want. I don't know when you want it. I don't know why you want it. So I'm not going to tell you what to do with your money. I don't want to treat you like a dentist treated Clarence Hughes. But doctors and dentists aren't useless, obviously. They have knowledge. They know the odds. They know what tends to work, even if patients come to different conclusions about what kind of treatment is right for them. Financial advisors are the same. There are universal truths in money, even if people come to different conclusions about how they want to apply those truths to their own finances. With that caveat in place, let's look at a few short recommendations that can help you make better decisions with your money. Go out of your way to find humility when things are going right, and forgiveness and compassion when they go wrong, because it's never as good or as bad as it looks. The world is big and complex. Luck and risk are both real and hard to identify. Do so when judging both yourself and others. Respect the power of luck and risk, and you'll have a better chance of focusing on things you can actually control. You'll also have a better chance of finding the right role models. Less ego, more wealth. Saving money is the gap between your ego and your income, and wealth is what you don't see. So wealth is created by suppressing what you could buy today in order to have more stuff or more options in the future. No matter how much you earn, you will never build wealth unless you can put a lid on how much fun you can have with your money right now, today. Manage your money in a way that helps you sleep at night. That's different from saying you should aim to earn the highest returns or save a specific percentage of your income. Some people won't sleep well unless they're earning the highest returns. Others will only get a good rest if they're conservatively invested. To each their own. But the foundation of, does this help me sleep at night, is the best universal guidepost for all financial decisions. If you want to do better as an investor, the single most powerful thing you can do is increase your time horizon. Time is the most powerful force in investing. It makes little things grow big and big mistakes fade away. It can't neutralize luck and risk, but it pushes results closer towards what people deserve. Become okay with a lot of things going wrong. You can be wrong half the time and still make a fortune, because a small minority of things account for the majority of outcomes. No matter what you're doing with your money, you should be comfortable with a lot of stuff not working. That's just how the world is. So you should always measure how you've done by looking at your full portfolio rather than individual investments. It is fine to have a large chunk of poor investments and a few outstanding ones. That's usually the best case scenario. Judging how you've done by focusing on individual investments makes winners look more brilliant than they were and losers more regrettable than they should. Use money to gain control over your time, because not having control of your time is such a powerful and universal drag on happiness. The ability to do what you want, when you want, with who you want, for as long as you want to, pays the highest dividend that exists in finance. Be nicer and less flashy. No one is impressed with your possessions as much as you are. You might think you want a fancy car or a nice watch, but what you probably want is respect and admiration. And you're more likely to gain those things through kindness and humility than horsepower and chrome. Save. Just save. You don't need a specific reason to save. It's great to save for a car or a down payment or a medical emergency, but saving for things that are impossible to predict or define is one of the best reasons to save. Everyone's life is a continuous chain of surprises. Savings that aren't earmarked for anything in particular is a hedge against life's inevitable ability to surprise the hell out of you at the worst possible moment. Define the cost of success and be ready to pay it, because nothing worthwhile is free. And remember that most financial costs don't have visible price tags. Uncertainty, doubt, and regret are common costs in the finance world. They're often worth paying, but you have to view them as fees, a price worth paying to get something nice in exchange, rather than fines, a penalty you should avoid. Worship room for error. A gap between what could happen in the future and what you need to happen in the future in order to do well is what gives you endurance. And endurance is what makes compounding magic over time. Room for error often looks like a conservative hedge, but if it keeps you in the game, it can pay for itself many times over. Avoid the extreme ends of financial decisions. Everyone's goals and desires will change over time, and the more extreme your past decisions were, the more you may regret them as you evolve. You should like risk because it pays off over time, but you should be paranoid of ruinous risk because it prevents you from taking future risks that will pay off over time. Define the game you're playing, and make sure your actions are not being influenced by people playing a different game. Respect the mess. Smart, informed, and reasonable people can disagree in finance because people have vastly different goals and desires. There is no single right answer, just the answer that works for you. Now let me tell you what works for me. Chapter 20, Confessions. Sandy Gottsman, a billionaire investor who founded consulting group First Manhattan, is said to ask one question when interviewing candidates for his investment team. What do you own and why? Not what stocks do you think are cheap or what economy is about to have a recession. Just show me what you do with your own money. I love this question because it highlights what can often be a mile-wide gap between what makes sense, which is what people suggest you do, and what feels right to them, which is what they actually do. Half of all U.S. mutual fund portfolio managers do not invest a cent of their own money in their funds, according to Morningstar. This might seem atrocious, and surely the statistic uncovers some hypocrisy. But this kind of stuff is more common than you'd think. Ken Murray, a professor of medicine at USC, wrote an essay in 2011 titled, How Doctors Die, that showed the degree to which doctors choose different end-of-life treatment for themselves than they recommend for their patients. Doctors don't die like the rest of us, he wrote. What's unusual about them is not how much treatment they get compared to most Americans, but how little. For all the time they spend fending off the deaths of others, they tend to be fairly serene when faced with death themselves. They know exactly what is going to happen, they know the choices, and they generally have access to any sort of medical care they could want. But they go gently. A doctor may throw the kitchen sink at her patient's cancer, but choose palliative care for herself. The difference between what someone suggests you do and what they do for themselves isn't always a bad thing. It just underscores that when dealing with complicated and emotional issues that affect you and your family, there is no one right answer. There is no universal truth. There's only what works for you and your family, checking the boxes you want checked in a way that leaves you comfortable and sleeping well at night. There are basic principles that must be adhered to. This is true in finance and in medicine, but important financial decisions are not made in spreadsheets or in textbooks. They are made at the dinner table. They often aren't made with the intention of maximizing returns, but minimizing the chance of disappointing a spouse or child. Those kinds of things are difficult to summarize in charts or formulas, and they vary widely from person to person. What works for one person may not work for another. You have to find what works for you. Here's what works for me. How my family thinks about savings. Charlie Munger once said, "I did not intend to get rich, I just wanted to get independent." We can leave aside rich, but independence has always been my personal financial goal. Chasing the highest returns or leveraging my assets to live the most luxurious life has little interest to me. Both look like games people do to impress their friends, and both have hidden risks. I mostly just want to wake up every day knowing my family and I can do whatever we want to do on our terms. Every financial decision we make revolves around that goal. My parents lived their adult years in two stages, dirt poor and moderately well off. My father became a doctor when he was 40 and already had three kids. Earning a doctor's salary did not offset the frugal mentality that is forced when supporting three hungry kids while in medical school. And my parents spent the good years living well below their means with a high savings rate. This gave them a degree of independence. My father was an emergency room doctor, one of the highest stress professions I can imagine, and one that requires a painful toggling of circadian rhythms between night and day shifts. After two decades, he decided he'd had enough. So he stopped, just quit, moved on to the next phase of his life. That stuck with me. Being able to wake up one morning and change what you're doing, on your terms, whenever you're ready, seems like the grandmother of all financial goals. Independence to me doesn't mean you'll stop working. It means you only do the work you like with people you like at the times you want for as long as you want. And achieving some level of independence does not rely on earning a doctor's income. It's mostly a matter of keeping your expectations in check and living below your means. Independence at any income level is driven by your savings rate. And past a certain level of income, your savings rate is driven by your ability to keep your lifestyle expectations from running away. My wife and I met in college and moved in with each other years before we got married. After school, we both had entry-level jobs with entry-level pay and settled into a moderate lifestyle. All lifestyles exist on a spectrum, and what is decent to one person can feel like royalty or poverty to another. But at our incomes, we got what we considered a decent apartment, a decent car, decent clothes, decent food. Comfortable, but nothing close to fancy. Despite more than a decade of rising incomes, myself in finance, my wife in healthcare, we've more or less stayed at that lifestyle ever since. That's pushed our savings rate continuously higher. Virtually every dollar of raise has accrued to savings, our independence fund. We now live considerably below our means, which tells you little about our income and more about our decision to maintain a lifestyle that we established in our 20s. If there's a part of our household financial plan I'm proud of, it's that we got the goalpost of lifestyle desires to stop moving at a young age. Our savings rate is fairly high, but we rarely feel like we're repressively frugal because our aspirations for more stuff haven't moved much. It's not that our aspirations are non-existent. We like nice stuff and live comfortably. We just got the goalpost to stop moving. This would not work for everyone, and it only works for us because we both agree to it equally. Neither of us are compromising for the other. Most of what we get pleasure from, going for walks, reading, podcasts, costs little, so we rarely feel like we're missing out. On the rare occasion when I question our savings rate, I think of the independence my parents earned from their years of high savings, and I quickly come back. Independence is our top goal. A secondary benefit of maintaining a lifestyle below what you can afford is avoiding the psychological treadmill of keeping up with the Joneses. Comfortably living below what you can afford without much desire for more removes a tremendous amount of social pressure that many people in the modern first world subject themselves to. Nassim Taleb explained, "True success is exiting some rat race to modulate one's activities for peace of mind." I like that. We're so far committed to the independence camp that we've done things that make little sense on paper. We own our house without a mortgage, which is the worst financial decision we've ever made, but the best money decision we've ever made. Mortgage interest rates were absurdly low when we bought our house. Any rational advisor would recommend taking advantage of cheap money and investing extra savings in higher return assets like stocks. But our goal isn't to be coldly rational, just psychologically reasonable. The independent feeling I get from owning our house outright far exceeds the known financial gain I'd get from leveraging our assets with a cheap mortgage. Eliminating the monthly payment feels better than maximizing the long-term value of our assets. It makes me feel independent. I don't try to defend this decision to those pointing out its flaws or those who would never do the same. On paper, it's defenseless. But it works for us. We like it. That's what matters. Good decisions aren't always rational. At some point, you have to choose between being happy or being right. We do keep a higher percentage of our assets in cash than most financial advisors would recommend, something around 20% of our assets outside the value of our house. This is also close to indefensible on paper, and I'm not recommending it to others. It's just what works for us. We do it because cash is the oxygen of independence, and more importantly, we never want to be forced to sell the stocks we own. We want the probability of facing a huge expense and needing to liquidate stocks to cover it to be as close to zero as possible. Perhaps we just have a lower risk tolerance than others. But everything I've learned about personal finance tells me that everyone, without exception, will eventually face a huge expense they did not expect. And they don't plan for these expenses specifically because they did not expect them. The few people who know the details of our finances ask, "What are you saving for? A house? A boat? A new car?" No, none of those. I'm saving for a world where curveballs are more common than we expect. Not being forced to sell stocks to cover an expense also means we're increasing the odds of letting the stocks we own compound for the longest period of time. Charlie Munger put it well. The first rule of compounding is to never interrupt it unnecessarily. How my family thinks about investing. I started my career as a stock picker. At the time, we only owned individual stocks, mostly large companies like Berkshire Hathaway and Procter & Gamble, mixed with smaller stocks I considered deep value investments. Go back to my 20s, and at any given point, I held something like 25 individual stocks. I don't know how I did as a stock picker. Did I beat the market? I'm not sure. Like most who try, I didn't keep a good score. Either way, I've shifted my views, and now every stock we own is a low-cost index fund. I don't have anything against actively picking stocks, either on your own or through giving your money to an active fund manager. I think some people can outperform the market averages. It's just very hard, and harder than most people think. If I had to summarize my views on investing, it's this. Every investor should pick a strategy that has the highest odds of successfully meeting their goals. And I think for most investors, dollar-cost averaging into a low-cost index fund will provide the highest odds of long-term success. That doesn't mean index investing will always work. It doesn't mean it's for everyone. And it doesn't mean active stock picking is doomed to fail. In general, this industry has become too entrenched on one side or the other, particularly those vehemently against active investing. Beating the market should be hard. The odds of success should be low. If they weren't, everyone would do it. And if everyone did it, there would be no opportunity. So no one should be surprised that the majority of those trying to beat the market fail to do so. The statistics show 85% of large cap active managers didn't beat the S&P 500 over the decade ending 2019. I know people who think it's insane to try to beat the market, but encourage their kids to reach for the stars and try to become professional athletes. To each their own. Life is about playing the odds, and we all think about odds a little differently. Over the years, I came around to the view that we'll have a high chance of meeting all of our family's financial goals if we consistently invest money into a low-cost index fund for decades on end, leaving the money alone to compound. A lot of this view comes from our lifestyle of frugal spending. If you can meet all your goals without having to take the added risk that comes from trying to outperform the market, then what's the point of even trying? I can afford to not be the greatest investor in the world, but I can't afford to be a bad one. When I think of it that way, the choice to buy the index and hold on is a no-brainer for us. I know not everyone will agree with that logic, especially my friends whose job it is to beat the market. I respect what they do, but this is what works for us. We invest money from every paycheck into these index funds, a combination of U.S. and international stocks. There's no set goal. It's just whatever is left over after we spend. We max out retirement accounts in the same funds and contribute to our kids' 529 college savings plans. And that's about it. Effectively, all of our net worth is a house, a checking account, and some Vanguard index funds. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that for us. I like it simple. One of my deeply held investing beliefs is that there is little correlation between investment effort and investment results. The reason is because the world is driven by tails. A few variables account for the majority of returns. No matter how hard you try at investing, you won't do well if you miss the two or three things that move the needle in your strategy. The reverse is true. Simple investment strategies can work great as long as they capture the few things that are important to that strategy's success. My investing strategy doesn't rely on picking the right sector or timing the next recession. It relies on a high savings rate, patience, and optimism that the global economy will create value over the next several decades. I spend virtually all of my investing effort thinking about those three things, especially the first two, which I can control. I've changed my investment strategy in the past, so of course there's a chance I'll change it in the future. No matter how we save or invest, I'm sure we'll always have the goal of independence, and we'll always do whatever maximizes for sleeping well at night. We think it's the ultimate goal, the mastery of the psychology of money. But to each their own, no one is crazy. Postscript: a brief history of why the U.S. consumer thinks the way they do. To understand the psychology of the modern consumer and to grasp where they might be heading next, you have to know how they got here, how we all got here. If you fell asleep in 1945 and woke up in 2020, you would not recognize the world around you. The amount of economic growth that took place during that period is virtually unprecedented. If you saw the level of wealth in New York and San Francisco, you'd be shocked. If you compared it to the poverty of Detroit, you'd be shocked. If you saw the price of homes, college tuition, and healthcare, you'd be shocked. If you saw how average Americans think about savings and spending in general, you'd be shocked. And if you tried to think of a reasonable narrative of how it all happened, my guess is you'd be totally wrong. Because it isn't intuitive, and it wasn't foreseeable. What happened in America since the end of World War II is the story of the American consumer. It's a story that helps explain why people think about money the way they do today. The short story is this. Things were very uncertain, then they were very good, then pretty bad, then really good, then really bad, and now here we are. And there is, I think, a narrative that links all those events together. Not a detailed account, but a story of how things fit together. Since this is an attempt to link the big events together, it leaves out many details of what happened during this period. I'm likely to agree with anyone who points out what I've missed. The goal here is not to describe every play. It's to look at how one game influenced the next. Here's how the modern consumer got here. 1. August 1945, World War II ends. Japan surrendering was the happiest day in American history, the New York Times wrote. But there's the saying, history is just one damn thing after another. The joy of the war ending was quickly met with the question, what happens now? 16 million Americans, 11% of the population, served in the war. About 8 million were overseas at the end. Their average age was 23. Within 18 months, all but 1.5 million of them would be home and out of uniform. And then what? What were they going to do next? Where were they going to work? Where were they going to live? Those were the most important questions of the day for two reasons. One, no one knew the answers. Two, if they couldn't be answered quickly, the most likely scenario in the eyes of many economists was that the economy would slip back into the depths of the Great Depression. Three forces had built up during the war. One, housing construction ground to a halt, as virtually all production capacity was shifted to building war supplies. Fewer than 12,000 homes per month were built in 1943, equivalent to less than one new home per American city. Returning soldiers faced a severe housing shortage. Two, the specific jobs created during the war, building ships, tanks, and planes, were very suddenly not necessary after it, stopping with a speed and magnitude rarely seen in private business. It was unclear where soldiers could work. Three, the marriage rate spiked during and immediately after the war. Soldiers didn't want to return to their mother's basement. They wanted to start a family in their own home with a good job right away. This worried policymakers, especially since the Great Depression was still a recent memory, having ended just 5 years prior. In 1946, the Council of Economic Advisers delivered a report to President Truman, warning of a full-scale depression sometime in the next 1 to 4 years. They wrote in a separate 1947 memo summarizing a meeting with Truman, "We might be in some sort of recession period where we should have to be very sure of our ground as to whether recessionary forces might be in danger of getting out of hand. There is a substantial prospect which should not be overlooked that a further decline may increase the danger of a downward spiral into depression conditions." This fear was exacerbated by the fact that exports couldn't be immediately relied upon for growth, as two of the largest economies, Europe and Japan, sat in ruins dealing with humanitarian crises. And America itself was buried in more debt than ever before, limiting direct government stimulus. So we did something about it. Two, low interest rates and the intentional birth of the American consumer. The first thing we did to keep the economy afloat after the war was keep interest rates low. This wasn't an easy decision, because when soldiers came home to a shortage of everything from clothes to cars, it temporarily sent inflation into double digits. The Federal Reserve was not politically independent before 1951. The President and the Fed could coordinate policy. In 1942, the Fed announced it would keep short-term rates at 0.38% to help finance the war. Rates didn't budge a single basis point for the next 7 years. 3-month Treasury yields stayed below 2% until the mid-1950s. The explicit reason for keeping rates down was to keep the cost of financing the equivalent of the $6 trillion we spent on the war low. But low rates also did something else for all the returning GIs. It made borrowing to buy homes, cars, gadgets, and toys really cheap, which, from a paranoid policymaker's perspective, was great. Consumption became an explicit economic strategy in the years after World War II. An era of encouraging thrift and saving to fund the war quickly turned into an era of actively promoting spending. Princeton historian Sheldon Guerin writes, "After 1945, America again diverged from patterns of savings promotion in Europe and East Asia. Politicians, businessmen, and labor leaders all encouraged Americans to spend to foster economic growth. Two things fueled this push. One was the GI Bill, which offered unprecedented mortgage opportunities. 16 million veterans could buy a home, often with no money down, no interest in the first year, and fixed rates so low that monthly mortgage payments could be lower than a rental. The second was an explosion of consumer debt, enabled by the loosening of Depression-era regulations. The first credit card was introduced in 1950. Store credit, installment credit, personal loans, payday loans, everything took off. And interest on all debt, including credit cards, was tax-deductible at the time. It tasted delicious, so we ate a lot of it. A simple story in a simple table. In 1945, total U.S. household debt was $29.4 billion. 1955, it was $125.7 billion. In 1965, total U.S. household debt was $331.2 billion. Household debt in the 1950s grew 1.5 times faster than it did during the 2000s debt splurge. 3. Pent-up demand for stuff, fed by a credit boom and a hidden 1930s productivity boom, led to an economic boom. The 1930s were the hardest economic decade in American history, but there was a silver lining that took 2 decades to notice. By necessity, the Great Depression had supercharged resourcefulness, productivity, and innovation. We didn't pay that much attention to the productivity boom in the 30s because everyone was focused on how bad the economy was. We didn't pay attention to it in the 40s because everyone was focused on the war. Then the 1950s came around and we suddenly realized, wow, we have some amazing new inventions and we're really good at making them. Appliances, cars, phones, air conditioning, electricity. It was nearly impossible to buy many household goods during the war because factories were converted to make guns and ships. That created pent-up demand from GIs for stuff after the war ended. Married, eager to get on with life, and emboldened with new cheap consumer debt, they went on a buying spree like the country had never seen. Frederick Lewis Allen writes in his book, The Big Change, "During these post-war years, the farmer bought a new tractor, a corn picker, an electric milking machine. In fact, he and his neighbors, between them, assembled a formidable array of farm machinery for their joint use. The farmer's wife got the shining white electric refrigerator she had always longed for and never during the Great Depression had been able to afford, and an up-to-date washing machine, and a deep freeze unit. The suburban family installed a dishwashing machine and invested in a power lawnmower. The city family became customers of a laundromat and acquired a television set for the living room. The husband's office was air-conditioned, and so on endlessly." It's hard to overstate how big this surge was. Commercial car and truck manufacturing virtually ceased from 1942 to 1945. Then, 21 million cars were sold from 1945 to 1949. Another 37 million were sold by 1955. Just under 2 million homes were built from 1940 to 1945. Then 7 million were built from 1945 to 1950. Another 8 million were built by 1955. Pent-up demand for stuff and our newfound ability to make stuff created the jobs that put returning GIs back to work. And they were good jobs, too. Mix that with consumer credit, and America's capacity for spending exploded. The Federal Reserve wrote to President Truman in 1951, "By 1950, total consumer expenditures, together with residential construction, amounted to about $203 billion, or in the neighborhood of 40% above the 1944 level." The answer to the question, what are all these GIs going to do after the war, was now obvious. They were going to buy stuff with money earned from their jobs making new stuff, helped by cheap borrowed money to buy even more stuff. 4. Gains are shared more equally than ever before. The defining characteristic of economics in the 1950s is that the country got rich by making the poor less poor. Average wages doubled from 1940 to 1948, then doubled again by 1963. And those gains focused on those who had been left behind for decades before. The gap between rich and poor narrowed by an extraordinary amount. Lewis Allen wrote in 1955, "The enormous lead of the well-to-do in the economic race has been considerably reduced. It is the industrial workers who, as a group, have done best. People such as a steelworker's family, who used to live on $2,500 and now are getting $4,500, or the highly skilled machine tool operator's family, who used to have $3,000 and now can spend an annual $5,500 or more. As for the top 1%, the really well-to-do and the rich, whom we might classify very roughly indeed as the 16,000 and over group, their share of the total national income after taxes had come down by 1945 from 13% to 7%. This was not a short-term trend. Real income for the bottom 20% of wage earners grew by a nearly identical amount as the top 5% from 1950 to 1980. The equality went beyond wages. Women held jobs outside the home in record numbers. Their labor force participation rate went from 31% after the war to 37% by 1955 and to 40% by 1965. Minorities gained too. After the 1945 inauguration, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote about an African-American reporter who told her, "Do you realize what 12 years have done? If at the 1933 reception, a number of colored people had gone down the line and mixed with everyone else in the way they did today, every paper in the country would have reported it. We do not even think it is news, and none of us will mention it." Women and minority rights were still a fraction of what they are today, but the progress toward equality in the late 40s and 50s was extraordinary. The leveling out of classes meant a leveling out of lifestyles. Normal people drove Chevys. Rich people drove Cadillacs. TV and radio equalized the entertainment and culture people enjoyed, regardless of class. Mail-order catalogs equalized the clothes people wore and the goods they bought, regardless of where they lived. Harper's Magazine noted in 1957, "The rich man smokes the same sort of cigarettes as the poor man, shaves with the same sort of razor, uses the same sort of telephone, vacuum cleaner, radio, and TV set, has the same sort of lighting and heating equipment in his house, and so on indefinitely. The differences between his automobile and the poor man's are minor. Essentially, they have similar engines, similar fittings. In the early years of the century, there was a hierarchy of automobiles." Paul Graham wrote in 2016 about what something as simple as there only being three TV stations did to equalize culture. "It's difficult to imagine now, but every night, tens of millions of families would sit down together in front of their TV set, watching the same show at the same time as their next-door neighbors. What happens now with the Super Bowl used to happen every night. We were literally in sync." This was important. People measure their well-being against their peers. And for most of the 1945 to 1980 period, people had a lot of what looked like peers to compare themselves to. Many people, most people, lived lives that were either equal or at least fathomable to those around them. The idea that people's lives equalized as much as their incomes is an important point of this story we'll come back to. 5. Debt rose tremendously, but so did incomes, so the impact wasn't a big deal. Household debt increased fivefold from 1947 to 1957 due to the combination of the new consumption culture, new debt products, and interest rates subsidized by government programs and held low by the Federal Reserve. But income growth was so strong during this period that the impact on households wasn't severe, and household debt was so low to begin with after the war. The Great Depression wiped out a lot of it, and household spending was so curtailed during the war that debt accumulation was restricted. So the growth in household debt to income from 1947 to 1957 was manageable. Household debt to income today is just over 100%. Even after rising in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, it stayed below 60%. Driving a lot of this debt boom was a surge in home ownership. The home ownership rate in 1900 was 47%. It stayed right about there for the next four decades. Then it took off, hitting 53% by 1945 and 62% by 1970. A substantial portion of the population was now using debt that previous generations would not, could not, have accessed. And they were mostly okay with it. David Halberstam writes in his book, The 50s, they were confident in themselves and their futures in a way that those growing up in harder times found striking. They did not fear debt as their parents had. They differed from their parents, not just in how much they made and what they owned, but in their belief that the future had already arrived. As the first homeowners in their families, they brought a new excitement and pride with them to the store as they bought furniture or appliances. In other times, young couples might have exhibited such feelings as they bought clothes for their first baby. It was as if the very accomplishment of owning a home reflected such an immense breakthrough that nothing was too good to buy for it. Now's a good time to connect a few things, as they'll become increasingly important. America is booming. It's booming together like never before. It's booming with debt that isn't a big deal at the time because it's still low relative to income, and there's a cultural acceptance that debt isn't a scary thing. 6. Things start cracking. 1973 was the first year where it became clear the economy was walking down a new path. The recession that began that year brought unemployment to the highest it had been since the 1930s. Inflation surged, but unlike the post-war spikes, it stayed high. Short-term interest rates hit 8% in 1973, up from 2.5% a decade earlier. And you have to put all of that in the context of how much fear there was between Vietnam, riots, and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and John and Bobby Kennedy. It got bleak. America dominated the world economy in the two decades after the war. Many of the largest countries had their manufacturing capacity bombed into rubble. But as the 1970s emerged, that changed. Japan was booming. China's economy was opening up. The Middle East was flexing its oil muscles. A combination of lucky economic advantages and a culture shared by the greatest generation, hardened by the Depression and anchored in systematic cooperation from the war, shifted when baby boomers began coming of age. A new generation that had a different view of what's normal hit at the same time a lot of the economic tailwinds of the previous two decades ended. Everything in finance is data within the context of expectations. One of the biggest shifts of the last century happened when the economic winds began blowing in a different, uneven direction, but people's expectations were still rooted in a post-war culture of equality. Not necessarily equality of income, although there was that, but equality in lifestyle and consumption expectations. The idea that somebody earning a 50th percentile income shouldn't live a life dramatically different than someone in the 80th or 90th percentile, and that someone in the 99th percentile lived a better life, but still a life that someone in the 50th percentile could comprehend. That's how America worked for most of the 1945 to 1980 period. It doesn't matter whether you think that's morally right or wrong. It just matters that it happened. Expectations always move slower than facts. And the economic facts of the years between the early 1970s through the early 2000s were that growth continued, but became more uneven, yet people's expectations of how their lifestyle should compare to their peers did not change. 7. The boom resumes, but it's different than before. Ronald Reagan's 1984 Morning in America ad declared, "It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future." That wasn't hyperbole. GDP growth was the highest it had been since the 1950s. By 1989, there were 7 million fewer unemployed Americans than there were 7 years before. The S&P 500 rose almost fourfold between 1982 and 1990. Total real GDP growth in the 1990s was roughly equal to that of the 1950s, 40% versus 42%. President Clinton boasted in his 2000 State of the Union speech, "We begin the new century with over 20 million new jobs, the fastest economic growth in more than 30 years, the lowest unemployment rates in 30 years, the lowest poverty rates in 20 years, the lowest African American and Hispanic unemployment rates on record, the first back-to-back surpluses in 42 years, and next month, America will achieve the longest period of economic growth in our entire history. We have built a new economy." His last sentence was important. It was a new economy. The biggest difference between the economy of the 1945 to 1973 period and that of the 1982 to 2000 period was that the same amount of growth found its way into totally different pockets. You've probably heard these numbers, but they're worth rehashing. The Atlantic writes, "Between 1993 and 2012, the top 1% saw their incomes grow 86.1%, while the bottom 99% saw just 6.6% growth." Joseph Stiglitz in 2011, "While the top 1% have seen their incomes rise 18% over the past decade, those in the middle have actually seen their incomes fall. For men with only high school degrees, the decline has been precipitous, 12% in the last quarter century alone." It was nearly the opposite of the flattening that occurred after the war. Why this happened is one of the nastiest debates in economics, topped only by the debate over what we should do about it. Lucky for the purpose of this discussion, neither matters. All that matters is that sharp inequality became a force over the last 35 years, and it happened during a period where, culturally, Americans held on to two ideas rooted in the post-World War II economy: that you should live a lifestyle similar to most other Americans, and that taking on debt to finance that lifestyle is acceptable. 8. The big stretch. Rising incomes among a small group of Americans led to that group breaking away in lifestyle. They bought bigger homes, nicer cars, went to expensive schools, and took fancy vacations. And everyone else was watching, fueled by Madison Avenue in the 80s and 90s, and the internet after that. The lifestyles of a small portion of legitimately rich Americans inflated the aspirations of the majority of Americans, whose incomes weren't rising. A culture of equality and togetherness that came out of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s innocently morphs into a keeping up with the Joneses effect. Now you can see the problem. Joe, an investment banker making $900,000 a year, buys a 4,000 square foot house with two Mercedes and sends three of his kids to Pepperdine. He can afford it. Peter, a bank branch manager making $80,000 a year, sees Joe and feels a subconscious sense of entitlement to live a similar lifestyle, because Peter's parents believed and instilled in him that Americans' lifestyles weren't that different, even if they had different jobs. His parents were right during their era, because incomes fell into a tight distribution. But that was then. Peter lives in a different world, but his expectations haven't changed much from his parents, even if the facts have. So what does Peter do? He takes out a huge mortgage. He has $45,000 of credit card debt. He leases two cars. His kids will graduate with heavy student loans. He can't afford the stuff, Joe can, but he's pushed to stretch for the same lifestyle. It is a big stretch. This would have seemed preposterous to someone in the 1930s, but we've spent 75 years since the end of the war fostering a cultural acceptance of household debt. During a time when median wages were flat, the median new American home grew 50% larger. The average new American home now has more bathrooms than occupants. Nearly half have four or more bedrooms, up from 18% in 1983. The average car loan, adjusted for inflation, more than doubled between 1975 and 2003, from $12,300 to $27,900. And you know what happened to college costs and student loans. Household debt to income stayed about flat from 1963 to 1973. Then it climbed and climbed and climbed from around 60% in 1973 to more than 130% by 2007. Even as interest rates plunged from the early 1980s through 2020, the percentage of income going to debt service payments rose, and it skewed toward lower income groups. The share of income going toward debt and lease payments is just over 8% for the highest income groups, those with the biggest income gains, but over 21% for those below the 50th percentile. The difference between this climbing debt and the debt increase that took place during the 1950s and 60s is that the recent jump started from a high base. Economist Hyman Minsky described the beginning of debt crises, the moment when people take on more debt than they can service. It's an ugly, painful moment. It's like Wild E. Coyote looking down, realizing he's screwed, and falling precipitously. Which, of course, is what happened in 2008. 9. Once a paradigm is in place, it is very hard to turn it around. A lot of debt was shed after 2008, and then interest rates plunged. Household debt payments as a percentage of income are now at their lowest level in 35 years. But the response to 2008, necessary as it may have been, perpetuated some of the trends that got us here. Quantitative easing both prevented economic collapse and boosted asset prices, a boon for those who owned them, mostly rich people. The Fed backstopped corporate debt in 2008. That helped those who owned the debt, mostly rich people. Tax cuts over the last 20 years have predominantly gone to those with higher incomes. People with higher incomes send their kids to the best colleges. Those kids can go on to earn higher incomes and invest in corporate debt that will be backstopped by the Fed, own stocks that will be supported by various government policies, and so on. None of these things are problems in and of themselves, which is why they stay in place. But they're symptomatic of the bigger thing that's happened since the early 1980s. The economy works better for some people than others. Success isn't as meritocratic as it used to be, and when success is granted, it's rewarded with higher gains than in previous eras. You don't have to think that's morally right or wrong. And again, in this story, it doesn't matter why it happened. It just matters that it did happen. It just matters that it did happen. And it caused the economy to shift away from people's expectations that were set after the war. That there's a broad middle class without systematic inequality where your neighbors live next door and a few miles down the road live a life that's pretty similar to yours. Part of the reason these expectations have stuck around for 35 years after they shifted away from reality is because they felt so good for so many people when they were valid. Something that good, or at least the impression that it was that good, isn't easy to let go of. So people haven't let go of it, and they want it back. 10. The Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, Brexit, and Donald Trump each represents a group shouting, "Stop the ride, I want off." The details of their shouting are different, but they're all shouting, at least in part, because stuff isn't working for them within the context of the post-war expectation that stuff should work roughly the same for roughly everyone. You can scoff at linking the rise of Trump to income inequality alone, and you should. These things are always layers of complexity deep. But it's a key part of what drives people to think, "I don't live in the world I expected. That pisses me off. So screw this and screw you. I'm going to fight for something totally different because this, whatever it is, isn't working." Take that mentality and raise it to the power of Facebook, Instagram, and cable news, where people are more keenly aware of how other people live than ever before. It's gasoline on a flame. Benedict Evans says, the more the internet exposes people to new points of view, the angrier people get that different views exist. There's a big shift from the post-war economy, where the range of economic opinions were smaller, both because the actual range of outcomes was smaller, and because it wasn't as easy to see and learn what other people thought and how they lived. I'm not pessimistic. Economics is the story of cycles. Things come, things go. The unemployment rate is now the lowest it's been in decades. Wages are now actually growing faster for low-income workers than the rich. College costs, by and large, stop growing once grants are factored in. If everyone studied advances in healthcare, communication, transportation, and civil rights since the glorious 1950s, my guess is most wouldn't want to go back. But a central theme of this story is that expectations move slower than reality on the ground. That was true when people clung to 1950s expectations as the economy changed over the next 35 years. And even if a middle-class boom began today, expectations that the odds are stacked against everyone but those at the top may stick around. So the era of "this isn't working" may stick around. And the era of "we need something radically new right now, whatever it is," may stick around, which, in a way, is part of what starts events that led to things like World War II, where this story began. History is just one damn thing after another. This has been The Psychology of Money, Timeless Lessons on Wealth, Greed, and Happiness by Morgan Housel. Thank you for listening. This has been The Psychology of Money, Timeless Lessons on Wealth, Greed, and Happiness by Morgan Housel. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.